This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
I'm proposing that in the next 10 years, we're going to see a billion people die of starvation because I'm eating burgers, because I went to McDonald's. Rapid population decline or bust.
She gave us everything.
Each person on Earth is overestimating his or her abilities to muddle through when the world breaks down.
What we needed to grow and evolve.
Welcome to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. When it comes to the population bomb, our feature speaker today makes Paul Ehrlich sound like an optimist. Now it's over 30 years into the tragedy of exploding humanity on a small planet. Jack Alpert says it's time for rapid population decline or bust. That bust may haul down civilization, taking us back thousands of years. In Roman times, there were about 100 million humans on the planet. It turns out, according to Jack, with reasonable scientific investigation, that is the maximum sustainable population, 100 million, to live anything like our current lifestyle in the developed world. This year of 2011, somewhere on the planet, the 7 billionth baby will be born, along with almost 500,000 more babies, that very same day. Of course, other humans will die. All told, the number of humans on Earth increases by about 217,000 a day and climbing. This crushes people, economies, governments, other species, and the whole world environment. The crisis has arrived. It is time to hear from Jack Alpert. Long ago, he invented seatbelts, saving hundreds of thousands of lives, perhaps millions. He went on to research peculiarities in the human brain and personal functioning, strange human traits that could end this civilization to dangle on the edge of extinction. Those are strong words, and this is a strong radio program. I don't recommend it for the severely depressed or impressionable young children, say under age 9. Save this one for the grown-ups and young people whose lives are threatened.
The basic premise is that we're underestimating the human predicament. So the conversation that happened in this living room does not reflect, the piano that's going to fall on us. As concerned as you are and as aggressive as you are in getting the word out and helping people understand it and being scared about things that you think are out of whack, you're still underestimating the predicament. And so I think that's my line to the grandmother. I've got to figure out a way to trip her from everything's okay, I've lived my whole life, things have gotten better continuously, they've never gotten bad. I expect my kids to be in better shape than me. They're going to go to college and get a better education, and they're going to live longer, and they're going to have better health care. And whatever's going to happen is going to be better than what happened to me. My objective is to trip somebody and say, no, here's why it's not going to be better. In fact, for most people, it's going to be worse, and that's why you should focus on this.
There are three reasons, I think, why Jack Alpert will never be popular and why this radio program is difficult to make and difficult to listen to. Number one, Jack admits he is not a master communicator. He is an engineer, often operating in fields well ahead of his time, before social acceptance. Number two, the material is difficult to communicate. It must cross boundaries where conversation has been hidden or forbidden for years. At times, he is trying to express in his studies the limitations of the human mind, but those same limitations prevent many people from readily understanding it. Number three, the subject and the options are so horrible, we don't want to hear it, much less think about it. The food riots have already begun to bring down governments, threatening us with chaos in the coming decades. With the spectacle of mass suffering and starvation all over the world, and that heartbreak will enter even the most prosperous houses, like an accusing ghost over the dinner table. We must try. The scene was an unassuming living room in the home of a Greenpeace founder in the city of Vancouver, where Greenpeace was born. Six of the brightest minds gathered around to hear Jack Alpert and to again work through the endless question, what is to be done? Plus one Alex Smith with not enough microphones, permission granted to record what I could. My main microphone went to Jack Alpert. Then I did three follow-up phone interviews to get you audio suitable for radio. The interviews are with Rex Wyler, Greenpeace co-founder, historian for that organization, regularly published pundit on the environment and peak oil, Dr. William or Bill Reese, the co-inventor of the ecological footprint idea, an amazing thinker and scientist at the University of British Columbia, and with Vandy Savage, a community organizer, project leader, and person extraordinaire. No time to waste. Here is Jack Alpert telling the seatbelt story and how that led him to conclude humans may be too stupid to survive.
We put these seatbelts in. People stopped dying.
I mean, you said 26,000.
1 in 26,000 Americans would have died in their car if they would have worn their... The argument is that people didn't wear seatbelts, even though the data was perfectly clear that it was a really good idea. Okay? Really, I mean, I was disheartened. I was one of these, you know, do-good engineers, and I had done something good, and it wasn't going to make any difference.
It was not compulsory.
So they didn't, you know, we started building key interlocks and seatbelt interlocks and all kinds of things. Eventually, they just passed the law about you had to strap your baby in. And after that, if you grew up wearing your seatbelt, then kids today will put their seatbelts on automatically. But that's not the point. The point is that the polio vaccination had exactly the same function. If you got vaccinated, you didn't get injured. Now, the same decision maker who wouldn't think of not getting their child vaccinated was the same person who wouldn't wear their seatbelt. So things in the time domain, in certain time domains, are opaque. And so most of my research is about how do you make temporal activities where the action is today and the outcome is in the future, or the action of most of the people today, you know, not you by yourself, but you in a group, will change the future. In those domains, we suck. Okay? I wrote an interactive computer exam. I gave it to sixth graders. Okay, I gave them an island, I gave them a bag of beans, I gave them some cows, and if they planted the bean, they got 375 beans. When they were feeding the cows beans, if they fed them 500 beans, the cow lived. If they fed her 501 beans, she reproduced, and if you fed her 499 beans, she died. It was called the Hammurabi problem, and I just inverted it, so I took out all the uncertainty and made it possible for the kid to make the calculations using sixth grade math and fifth grade reading. So they could actually figure out how many animals were going to be alive at the end of the first year, how many animals are going to be alive at the end of the second year. They got points for 1 point for every animal was alive at the first year, 2 for the second year, so on. And then 2,000 points off for every animal you killed. So this is a pretty easy problem. And not only that, you can figure your way out through the problem and then come back and make your decisions in the first year. Well, only one kid of all the Palo Alto sixth graders that I gave it to could do it. One. The rest failed miserably. So then I said, well, let's go from sixth graders to Stanford students. They got to be brighter. They're older. They're filtered. Yeah. Nobody did it. So then I said, I then went to the faculty and I had them do it. And then my final group was all the Nobel laureates and Wolf Prize winners that I could snake into having to take the exam. From the scores, and these are, you know, this is not a really good statistical problem. I mean, it's not, the experiment would have had to have been redone carefully. But the inference is that in this domain of understanding, the Nobel laureates and the sixth graders are in the same park. They have the same abilities and they suck. When there's no uncertainty and there's a way to calculate out the implications of your actions, you would rather do trial and error and die than they weren't willing to use logic. They wanted to experiment through the crisis, which is what our society is doing. We're facing this crisis, and we want to experiment our way through, and the probability that we're going to be successful this time around experimenting our way through is...
In case we miss it, humans might well go to hell or even extinction because of a limitation in our brains. Even though we have the capability to work out what the future will be and a way to get to a better future, we prefer to muddle through using trial and error. And we'll do it time after time. That is true of sixth graders, of college professors, and Nobel laureates. Only one person, a child, ever stopped to figure out the right answer to Jack's puzzle. That person later invented a basic building block of the internet communication among humans. Just one. Case in point, human-induced climate change. We know what triggers big changes, our changes to the atmosphere. We know what will happen. We know how to fix it. But we'd have to give up some things now. Instead, we keep burning fossil fuels and leave it to our kids and grandkids to muddle through. We believe in muddling through. It's always better than a plan. That is our nature. The same thing happens with an obviously non-renewable resource like oil. We know it will run out, but expect to muddle through rather than taking action now to prevent a future collapse. If Jack Alpert only contributes one thing to the world, this alone will be enough. Humans will use trial and error even when an obvious logical path to success is available. That is the nature of the beast. That is our next challenge for evolution. Or can cultural evolution, based on science, overcome this innate flaw? Alpert has given up on the mass media and mass politics to affect social change. He also does not believe current politicians will begin rapid population reduction. Instead, he wants to create tools that will change the mind of just one person. He has chosen a campaign to target grandmothers. He wants to convince just one grandmother to wear a button saying RPD for rapid population decline, and to give the tools to that grandmother to convert another grandmother. If each just converts one more a month, and it spreads in a viral way, in about 32 months, millions of grandmothers will be wearing these buttons at the next rallies. Jack Alpert has calculated there are enough grandmothers in America who vote to outweigh all the other voters who will be split in their loyalties to other parties and all the young people who don't vote, even though they could. To get the grandmothers' votes, the politician would have to promise a program of rapid population decline at home and abroad. Later, we will hear Jack explain his main conclusion that only rapid population decline can save us from horror or oblivion. Cuts in developed world lifestyles will not save us in time, he says, and nobody wants to cut back on their lifestyles anyway, unless they're forced to, and then it's too late. People all over the world want to live the fossil-fueled life party of plenty, or at least to have some dependable food, light, heat, electricity. Given what we have seen already, that humans are not willing to change lifestyles very much, the only solution is to have a lot less humans. Later, Jack will show us how many humans could inhabit this planet and live the way we do, sustainably, for thousands of years or endlessly. But first, let's hear Jack explain one way to achieve rapid population decline.
No, there's nothing sexual about this. In my model, everybody gets to be sterile, and everybody get and the reversals are handed out completely randomly. I believe the world can peacefully and sustainably support one person for every 100 people that exist today, and that is essentially the population of South Korea. So we're talking about a really small number of people.
At what consumption level?
I'm going to take all the resources and bring them over to some great location where they can live and don't have to transport things far, and thus they have the highest possible standard of living for that number. And if they don't like how they want it higher, they need a smaller number. Okay, what do I mean by rapid? In the lifetime of my children. And the faster the decline, the better, because even if we started implementing rapid population decline tomorrow, it would not save a billion people who are going to starve to death in the next 10 years. And it won't save the 2 or 3 billion people who will die fighting to stay alive in the next 20 years, as their labor will not provide the means to support them. However, I do believe implementing rapid population decline might avoid a complete bust. It might avoid a civilization collapse that would turn all children into this child. Know the conclusion. We're underestimating overpopulation. The only justification for giving out 350,000 birth permits for the whole globe is a realization that you can only have 35 million people in 70 years, or nobody will die from a natural death. They're all going to be fighting with one another. It'll all be social conflict. Everybody's sterile, and the permit allows you to get it reversed.
Yeah, but everybody's not sterile.
Everybody will be sterile. Let's assume that
let's assume
there's actually a virus loose in the population.
Let's assume that we get Bill Gates to put $35 billion into building a sterility virus.
Are you going to get people into it?
Aerosol. I mean, we're talking about the technical. You want some shock value? Let's assume that the city goes under and the grocery stores are empty and you live at the edge of the city. Okay? And here comes this guy with this little girl and they haven't eaten for 3 days. And he marches up on your front porch, and he says, really, we're really hungry. We haven't eaten in 3 days. And you have a choice between letting him in and feeding him, which means that your kids aren't going to have food, or sending him away, or if he doesn't want to go away, you have to shoot him or he's going to shoot you. When you're faced with that dilemma, when these bodies start piling up on your front porch because your cupboard is full and his cupboard is not, I mean, he's not a normal person. I mean, he's not.
You're already piling up on our front porch, and we're adding 80 million bodies a year to.
Diluted. 80 million extra people means nothing. 17 fathers and little girls that are piled up on my front porch because I had to shoot them or feed them. You know, his kids are mine. If I can create that reality, that this is your choice. I mean, the road, eat or be eaten, kind of thing. If a grandmother can swallow the road in its implication, that it doesn't take much to flip our society upside down, at which point that's your choice. And now you have to say, do I want to do something about it before the fact?
That goes back to your original argument, though, when you were talking about trying to get people to do things with the beans and the cows.
Right. I mean, they can't. They're not wired up for that.
Desperate times call for desperate measures, and that is about as desperate as they come. Alpert says one way humans can cull themselves nonviolently is to give up their rights to have children. Reproduction will happen only for the lucky few drawn from a birth lottery run by the governments. This is horrible, but not as horrible, perhaps, as severe other alternative routes, such as die-off by starvation, nuclear war, or viral weapons. We'll get to that. To get the population reduced fast enough to save the planet, Alpert calculates the whole world could issue 350,000 birth permits a year. In the next 60 or 70 years, that would reduce the U.S. population, for example, to 40 or 50 million people, a number that could be supported by the natural resources of the country, perhaps. Alpert presents the way civilizations collapse, based on a death spiral model triggered by scarcity. Responses to scarcity bring more scarcity. And there's the spiral.
So what makes civilization collapse? Rome collapsed because of too much scarcity. Not enough food is grown. Not enough food got to market. What gets to market is bought by the rich. The poor cannot afford to eat. They get desperate and they fight to eat. The owners and the rich defend themselves. The fighting and defending consumes resources which make more scarcity, which makes more fighting, more defending. And I call this a civilization death spiral. One, if scarcity is diminishing, the civilization death spiral does not trigger, which explains why civilizations thrive. Two, increasing scarcity triggers a spiral. Three, once the spiral is going, it keeps going. No further input, for example, from a failed harvest is required. Four, the civilization death spiral mechanism is embedded in every civilization. It was embedded in these four, and five, they're all gone. The scarcity conflict death spiral is embedded in our civilization. Scarcity can cause failure, and when it does, it will affect all the people in the world. Why? Because previous civilizations did not share supporting resources. Chinese civilization could have scarcity and failure, and a Greek civilization wouldn't be affected by it. But today, all resources are shared in markets. Sea lanes allow wheat that's grown in Russia or China or Iowa to be delivered and eaten in Africa, Asia, or New York. And hidden by the market, a failed Russian harvest creates scarcity in Egypt. And hidden by a market, rich people don't even know when they are taking the food out of poor people's mouths. And they don't know where these people are. And when gas prices rise 10 cents a gallon in a day, most people don't know what caused it. And when oil rose from $70 to $140 a barrel in a few months, most did not know what caused it. However, because planting and fertilizing and transporting and processing all depend on fuel, food costs doubled, and it caused food riots. And the doubling of food costs reduces everyone's well-being. It increases everyone's scarcity, increases conflict between all individuals and institutions. And while poor nations riot, rich nations experience rising unemployment. And belligerence arises between neighbors. That's how Germany took Poland. And today, resource wars are putting consuming nations against nations that have resources or nations that have competing consumers. Everyone must defend themselves. Everyone pays for this defense. Everyone loses more well-being. Everyone experiences a little increase in scarcity, more defending. The death spiral kicks in. Global civilization collapses. And to make this dynamic more personal, this is my son, Benny. And Benny's life changes. I don't want this to happen to Benny. So my task tonight is to show what behaviors and system characteristics increase scarcity. Increase it enough to trigger a civilization death spiral and turn Benny into a gun-toting orphan. And in the end, I will show that saving Benny requires rapid population decline. So that's my work on my grandmother. She's got to believe that if we don't keep civilization from going under, her progeny are going to get crushed. So let me present a model that activates the death spiral.
Then he presents a kind of interactive graph of forces that create scarcity in the hopes of understanding what we might control to avoid the death spiral or even reverse it. Rex Weiler comments that many of the functions presented by Alpert were already predicted in the 1972 book Limits to Growth. Randy Savage points out that peak oil needs to be factored in, and women react differently than men. Bill Reese, who has been quiet until now, wonders if humans have enough rationality to find any solution at all. Filmmaker John Cooksey has a brilliant critique at this point, but I couldn't get it on the microphone. Alpert argues that declining population will create much more wealth rather than less, for example, if you have four grandparents, each with houses and assets perhaps, but only two descendants, they get two houses each. As the population declines, there will be more stuff and resources for each person on the planet. The argument that growth of population is necessary to create more wealth is stood on its head. Jack shows a video which is available on his website at skill.org, that is skil.org. The video tries to answer this question. If everyone lived a North American lifestyle, how many humans can Earth support sustainably throughout time? That number, Alpert says, is far below 100 million. In the real world, people want to keep living well-fed, possibly on meat. They want to travel around, have normally acceptable homes and all that. We can do it, but only with the ideal population, just 100 million humans. It would be up to 300 million with some reductions in consumption. That takes us to the population that existed around the year zero in the Christian calendar, the time of the Roman Empire in the West. One of the main limitations, seldom taken into account, says Alpert, is the time it takes to regenerate soil. Currently, we are losing topsoil at a tremendous rate to water and wind erosion, plus draining micronutrients by overcropping. We replace some of the nutrients with fossil fuel-based fertilizers, which are not sustainable. Quoting Alpert from the online video, which he showed us, sustainable farming practice means the amount of soil lost equals the amount created. However, today's farming practice loses soil on average 16 times faster than Mother Nature makes it. That is, it would take 15 years to replace what is lost in a year of farming. On average, to be sustainable, after an acre is farmed, it would have to remain fallow for 15 years. This means we could only farm 1/16th of our land. The peaceful world population living in North American lifestyles with sustainable soil practices is 100 million people. A little later, he discusses whether permaculture can shorten that and increase the population somewhat, but that's the figures. But Alpert says even that 100 million figure is too high. There are other factors. For example, people want to live longer. Suppose through a medical advance or diet changes, humans reach an average life expectancy of 87 years instead of 86. That extra year increases their consumption by a little over 1%. We have to reduce the number of humans accordingly to keep things sustainable. Humans will always long for more improvements. With every increase in the ideal of consumption, the global population has to decrease accordingly. There can be continual progress, to a point, as long as the population continues to decline, says Alpert. To a point, because, and this caused a great deal of argument at the dinner meeting, because we do not know how many humans it takes to create our modern industrial lifestyle. Rex Weiler points to the numberless humans working behind the scenes, digging up ores, working in factories, transporting goods, repairing infrastructure. Could 100 million humans keep it all up? We don't know.
In 8 short years, everybody's worried about when the bad stuff's going to happen. In 8 short years, the rich will have taken it all. The poor will have nothing in their markets to purchase. The poor's land will have been purchased by the rich to grow food or flowers or park cars. And the poor will not eat. For example, 1 billion Chinese, Indian, and others in developing world's middle class are beginning to eat a little meat and drive their own cars. And when the poor's hear a sucking sound in their meager markets, conflict and civilization will soon follow. So the idea is that the model is robust enough to predict that it's a pretty small number, and the time we have to come up with a way to get down to that small number is very short.
Another factor standing between the death spiral and the sustainably populated planet is the age-old problem: how are resources distributed between the rich and the poor? We know from history and sociological studies a greater inequality of wealth with a hierarchy to enforce it is more unstable. The top-down world requires more resources and therefore a smaller population again. Alpert shows how a change in the distribution of wealth radically changes the number of humans Earth could support sustainably. I'm going to try to summarize using mostly Jack's own words, starting here. Take a world like our own, where 80% of the world's resources go to just the top 20% of humans, with the rest of humanity living on the remaining 20%. If we reduce the population to 1.6 billion, the number of people in both top and bottom are cut to 25%. So everyone, both rich and poor, will get four times the resources they would in a world of 6.4 billion people. Suppose the richest group, the top 20%, did not expand their consumption four times as they could, but just stayed at North American lifestyles. Just dropping the population to 1.6 billion would mean that without reducing anyone's well-being or creating any scarcity or civilization collapse, all the humans on Earth could attain North American lifestyles and well-being. What if the disparity between rich and poor was even greater? Suppose just 10% of the world's people consumed 80% of the resources. Then the calculation of how much the population would have to decrease to give everyone a North American lifestyle, it changes. We would have to reduce from 6.4 billion humans to a population of 800 million. That ends my edited quoting from Jack's dinner presentation in Vancouver. As you can see, hierarchies, wealth distribution, and inequality are huge factors when trying to figure out what the Earth can support sustainably. It depends not just on resources available, but what kind of society we have. To achieve sustainability, taking into account water usage, minerals available, clean energy, soil restoration, and room for other species, we would have to go way down from 800 million to 100 million or less. Jack says privately he would be surprised if the necessary germ warfare for a mass sterilization was not already developed by the major powers. There has been more than half a century of research since the end of World War II, when the German Nazi scientists were already working on purposeful diseases. Just consider all the private and university research into all the components, including genetics, that has been done since then. It's a nightmare scenario, which makes voluntary mass sterilization and a birth lottery sound more benign than a horrible die-off. We cannot discount the possibility of a racially designed death germ either. Perhaps an evil scientist or government will decide Earth shall be populated by only white people or Chinese people, Jewish or Arabic people. It's horrible to think about. We humans seem left with these horrible possibilities. I won't call them options. Number one, a political solution with voluntary mass sterilization and an international birth lottery to have the sterilization reversed to have a baby. That's Jack Alpert's only plan so far. Number two, germ warfare, whether designed or released by a government, a corporation, or a deranged biology student, it is all terrorism. There might be an accident. There might be a plan with a vaccine ready for chosen survivors based on race, nationality, ability to pay, or just dumb luck. And number three, endure a century of general chaos leading to massive die-off in disease, war, and starvation. And we will all suffer in that. And number four, a magical alien discovers us in time and transports most of the population to Eden-like planets. Stay tuned for three informal responses in my follow-up telephone interviews with Rex Weiler, Vandy Savage, and Bill Reese.